My Deepest Fears by Janet Tavares was that I would never be able to come from behind the wall. I remember the first time I went behind in 1989. Rikers Island. I was terrified. I sat up all night on my cot, holding my knees close to my chest. I did 6 months. I was glad to go home. I didn't stay glad for long because I went back behind the wall 6 months later. This time I went to Taconic Correctional Facility. First, I hit Bedford Hills, where I saw the board and got hit with 3 months added to the 1.5 I was already sentenced to serve. This time I wasn't scared at all. I knew what awaited me behind the wall, to fight, fight, and fight. In fact, I was good at fighting. So even behind the wall, I was put behind another wall, which had 4 walls and a door. This place is called the box. My food was served through the slot. Guard would bang on the door and yell, "Chow." Slowly but surely, my spirit for life was dying, and I didn't even realize it at the time. My spirit was dying because at times I preferred the box than to be in general population. Behind the wall, I could survive. There is a big difference between surviving and living. I was not prey, but at times I could be a predator and feed on those weaker than me. Little by little, I became cold and uncaring like the walls they kept me in. Once again, I went home. That sounds funny now to say home, because if it was home, why didn't I try to stay? Again, I returned behind the wall, this time 2.5 years, to a place we call Far Beyond, AKA Albion, 8.5 hours away from so-called home. I had become conditioned to being behind the wall. Then one day in Far Beyond, I realized that I was no longer 23 years old when I first started jailing, going behind the wall. Now, I was 28. Where had all the years gone? What did I do in this time? Nothing except die behind the walls, a death of dreams, hopes, and so many aspirations for life. The worst death I suffered was the death of my spirit. I looked around and saw my reality, to grow older and colder behind the wall. I thought one day I will be old in these hills knitting booties. Then the fear set in again. I will remain behind the wall if I don't change. Change did not come easy at all, but it came. Change was hard for me on the outside. In fact, at time I felt it was easier behind the wall. I felt I had no purpose. Even worse, I felt worthless. I have a brother who did 20 years behind the wall. He found life outside the wall. He found his purpose and worth while behind the wall. He found out that his true father is a king. He is the son of the only king there is. In this process of change, I struggled with so many dreams and demons. Now I really needed to fight. Fight for a life, fight for dreams, fight for hope, fight to find my purpose, fight to gain a spirit, fight to find a life outside the walls that had kept me prisoner for so long. Even worse was my own self-inflicted prison of my mind. This has been my hardest fight. I'm trying to find a better way. I came across some women who found a better way than being behind the wall. These women helped me find a purpose and worth. I could truly find my true worth as the daughter of a king. So today I stand before you free. In so many ways, free because I found life outside the wall. Women on the Rise Telling Her Story is an organization that's run and led by currently and formerly incarcerated women. And the reason why our stories are so important is because it informs people who have not had the experience of being in prison, the experience of prison, and that's exactly what it is. It's an experience. I'm formerly incarcerated. I was arrested 61 times. I served in total, 5.5 years in state facility. I've been home for 19 years. My last arrest, I was arrested pregnant. I gave birth to my son behind the wall, and I was shackled and handcuffed during birth and delivery. I walked out of prison with my son, who was 9 months old, and I swore that I'd never go back there again. However, I knew who I was leaving behind, and I knew that I was leaving a multitude of sisters who would experience the dehumanizing and oppressive conditions that I had experienced, and theirs would be ongoing while I was going on home. And I had to do something about it. So my mission has been, and my passion has been, to change the practices both in prison and outside of prison. But how do you do that? Women and resistance. Like some of the stats my colleagues have mentioned are the same in Canada as in the United States. If anything, I think Canada's following suit. People of color are most impacted, and poor people especially. It's a war on poverty. It's a war on poverty, that's exactly what it is. And, you know, we look at it and we say, oh, well, you know, we try to classify people, and we were having this discussion last night, we try to classify people based on their crime to kind of feel better about who we have in the room. So if you've not committed a crime of violence, then you're better than the person who's committed a nonviolent, you're worse than a person who's committed a nonviolent crime. People are people. You know, you so perfectly put it that you don't know who you're sitting next to, you don't know who you're talking to, and when you think about people who've been in prison, you don't know. You don't know. What do they look like? They don't get stamped on their forehead that I'm an ex-con when I leave, you know? So you don't know. And people don't want handouts, you know? They understand that it's a system that has truly impacted them because of what they look like, the color of their skin, where they live, and what they have available to them. And it's divisive. It's divisive. And if we as people don't talk about race, then we're doing a disservice because we're really not getting at the point. If you don't understand that it's poor people that are going to prison and it's people of color that are going to prison, indigenous people, people who were slaves in the beginning, they're people that have come up behind them, then, you know, you're missing the whole point. So, women and resistance, because we focus on women, and I don't want to go all over the place, so let me get back to my speech. So, I think I was talking about Worth, right? And why Worth came about. It's an organization that's run and led by currently and formerly incarcerated women. And so one of the challenges we had was how do we address a system that basically keeps you from partnering with each other, because our parole mandates say that we're not allowed to be in the same room with another formerly incarcerated person on parole. But yet, parole will place us in the same programs together. So that's a contradiction. So what we did was we decided to do our organizing work in organizations where they mandated us to. And since they already said that we couldn't be together by our own, you know, work and our own ideas, we thought to do our organizing work where they said that we were mandated to. So we kind of went around that. And we did great work. So we operated as a transient organization, homeless. And we would meet and we would talk about what it is that we were going to do as an organization. We decided not to be a direct service organization, but to focus on advocacy and policy and the impacts of confinement for our sisters who we left behind and mutual aid for our sisters who were coming home. So we were women who were working in the criminal justice and human services fields. Some of us held positions that were supervisory and even executive director positions. And we had kind of been under the radar. And folks didn't know that, either we were in prison. So it was about how do we share what it is that we've experienced? How do we come out of the closet? How do we do really good work to move issues forward and change policies? So we began doing that, and we began sort of supporting our sisters when they came home. And we found them jobs. We offered them mutual aid. We found places for them to have conversations, to talk about the trauma, to sit down and eat food, to talk about their children. We gave them opportunities to really confront the systems and their collateral consequences that they were facing in reunification and housing, employment. And we found ourselves really successful. So we decided to take on policy. And one of the policies we took on, because we noticed that, again, here's the same statistics, 1 in 4 women in the United in New York State prisons were infected with HIV and Hep C. And most of the women in prison are Black and brown women. And so these women were coming home. And so we had some of our colleagues do maps within the communities that were most impacted by the war on drugs. And there were 7 communities that they identified in New York State that were impacted by the war on drugs. We took this same map and identified HIV stats. And in those same maps, in those communities, the stats were, the numbers were so high. And so we found that women that were impacted by HIV and Hep C were coming back to these same communities. And women in the communities, the first thing that when they come home, and they want the support of people that they know, you know. And unfortunately, or fortunately, we share the same partners, you know. So Mookie got around when Cindy was in prison, you know. And then when Cindy came home, Mookie came back, you know. So nobody got tested. Nobody found out whether they were infected, but it continued, you know. And so it was about educating women. And so that's one of the first things that we got involved in. And we got the Department of Health to pass a law to work with corrections that would lessen the stigma that women who were diagnosed with HIV and Hep C, and that they would not be stigmatized, and that they would have services upon their release. They would receive services during their incarceration, and that was education, and that was the proper medication, and not be scrutinized once they were released. So it wouldn't be something that they were afraid to go and get their medication because they were on a particular line, you know, or a separate line, but that it was more friendly according to how the system was run. And so we were able to really impact that particular issue inside and make some headway. The other thing that we found out was that, you know, they were taking our children and they were putting them up for adoption. And during the times that most of us were doing time, our median sentence was 36 months. They have a law in New York, and it's a federal law that's throughout the nation. And each state basically is an island unto itself on how these federal laws are passed and how they want to run these laws. So within New York, the Adoption Safe Families Act states that if you are incarcerated or in treatment, 15 to 22 months, they could begin to terminate your parental rights. During the time, now this was enacted in 1976, and so during the time in 1976, the median sentence was 24 months. In 1998, it was 36 months. So how realistically, if you got a 36-month sentence, could you plan for the reunification of your child if they were placed in foster care due to your incarceration and your child would be there and they would begin to determine parental termination in 15 to 22 months? There's no way you would be able to plan for your child. And so what we did was we, again, organized, and specific to New York, we established what's called an Adoption Safe Families Act expanded discretion law, which is a law to look at particular cases where women are in prison and women are in treatment, and that their relationship with their child should be considered prior to a caseworker and a judge terminating parental rights. So if, let's say, she has a newborn baby, right? She doesn't have a relationship with the newborn baby, but she has other children that are in foster care. Look at that relationship that she has with the children. Was she there? Was she consistent with them? And make a case by case rather than an overall decision. on terminating a person's right and looking at the sentence that the person is saving before the termination of their parental rights was placed in front of the judge and passed. So we were able to pass that in 2009, and it saved a lot of parents from having their parental rights terminated. And women do time looking to be with their children once they're released. They cry for their children, they have fights for their children, and in most cases, because they're arrested and they're serving time for drug cases, it's not until the fog is lifted that they really realize that they've left their children behind. It never means that they don't love their children. We know that women do drugs and make choices because there are no choices. They're running from something, the trauma that they've experienced, abuse, or, you know, having to be a part of the street economy and the shame and the guilt and whatever comes with that, you know, is what continues to perpetuate that behavior. But they use drugs to kind of, you know, numb everything. We were able to become successful in that. And the last one was the one that was closer to my heart, which was in 2009, New York became the seventh state to end shackling of women during birth and delivery. And because 19 years before then, I was, well, not 19 years before then, my son was maybe 15 at the time. And I had really just thought that this law needed to be passed. And there was some legislation that was being presented where a woman had gone to the hospital from the prison from Bedford Hills, and they misplaced the key, and she was in labor. So they couldn't release her legs while she was in labor getting ready to give birth, and they had to call another CO from the prison to come and bring the key. And so when I found that out, I said, that was ridiculous. You know, that's absolutely ridiculous. So we organized to end shackling of women during labor and delivery. And I want to show you our national initiative that we've pulled together, which is called Birthing Behind Bars, as a result of winning that legislation. But when you think about resistance, right, of women, I've talked about some of the things that we've done as an organization and some of the things that we do as women. Women resist and have resisted forever, as long as we've been in situations where we've been oppressed and dehumanized, we've resisted, you know. And I so agree that it's not about you're feeling sorry for us and that we're not going to overcome this. It's your aligning with us so that we can move things forward and taking your privilege and using it in a way in which really infiltrates the systems, because the systems are in place and they're in place for a reason. It's not to break them down or throw them away. It's as they are, to be able to infiltrate them and change them so that they become effective. So how do you use your privilege? How do you use your status to assist in that?